You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In 2006, I recorded a speech in a church by British writer George Monbiot. George was touring for his climate book, Heat. He said that love miles might do us in. He meant the distances covered by so many of us, especially in airplanes, simply to see family members. George suggested we return to the older practice of marrying people who live close to us. It seemed shocking at the time. But it goes much deeper than that, from food miles to product shipping. Our next guest says we must all learn four new words as the mantra for our lives, live close to home. That's the title of a new book by Canadian author and scholar Peter Denton. Peter's an odd mixture. He teaches soldiers about religion and war at the Royal Military College of Canada. He's an ordained minister of the United Church. Dr. Denton holds 5 degrees. He's one of 2 regional representatives for the North American stakeholders at the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP. Denton writes seamlessly on military theory like battle space, about the essence and impact of technology, and the role of ethics in our survival. His newest book is about something all of us can do, really must do, to swing away from catastrophic emissions of greenhouse gases. From St. Andrews, Manitoba, Peter Denton, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much.
We have lots to talk about, but first, how would you introduce your new book to our audience?
In part, what I would say is it's the third in a series. And there are 3 different facets of my response to the questions around how we got here from there and how do we move forward into whatever future we choose. I think the key element here is choice. It's a recognition that our current situation is not the product of some divine plan. It's not the product of some universal necessity. It's the specific product of choices that people have made up to this point in time. And that whatever future we have is a consequence of the choices that we are going to make and are making ourselves today. So the question is, what kind of choices and to what end? And in this particular book, I realized that one of the key facets of our society, something that has spun up really since the 17th century, has been our fixation with life at a distance. That more than any civilization in history, we have found ways of being able to be elsewhere in terms of how we live. Not only is our food from somewhere else, our money is something that happens in the future because we're all living on credit. We don't marry that girl next door. We actually are far more interested in people thousands of miles away through the internet than anyone we actually can walk up to and talk to. So all of these things in combination have created a society in which what's near at hand is not nearly as interesting or valued or important as something far away. And when you start putting all of those pieces together, you pretty quickly come to realize the fragility of the situation in terms of our ability to continue in this fashion and the ways in which we need to regain control over what happens in our lives. And that ability to regain control focuses on what we actually can reach. So, you know, we can go hungry if we can't reach food with our own hands, with our own arms. So it's the realization that the only place in the world that we actually have control over is right close to home.
You know, a few months ago, a casual acquaintance raved about a big family wedding, I remember, and the bride and the groom and all 50 guests flew to Tahiti for a fabulous wedcation, let's say. And, you know, Peter, I almost gave up hope for our species. Why is this so wrong?
Well, it's a really good question, because we talk about ecotourism, for example, as a way to respond to the excesses of long-distance travel. I think ecotourism is essentially an oxymoron, because when you look at the environmental impact of tourists all around the planet, it's catastrophic. And yet we somehow excuse that because it's a family wedding, or we really must see that person again, or I've always wanted to, you know, scale the side of that volcano. And our efforts at home to live a more sustainable lifestyle seem to go straight out the window the moment we utter the word vacation.
Yeah, but you know, I have to admit, I've traveled the world just to see it, and only later did I learn the damage that I added to nature. Can we tell the next generation, Peter, don't do as we did?
Well, I think that often is the case. One generation tries to explain that to the next. No, don't make the same mistakes we did. I'm not sure how successful that ever is. I think this is one of the places where there needs to be a partnership and the realization together that it's not as simple as dividing this generation from the next generation, because we are all in this situation together. If you think of it in the context of how rapidly we have to make significant changes to how we live together, we're not talking 25, 30, 50 years. We're talking 5 years. And that means that someone who's 90 is as much a part of what's going on as someone who's 10. I think that realization of us all being in this situation together, that, as I like to say, in a round world, there is no place to hide. There's no corners you can hide in. There's no place to escape, that it affects all of us. So it's a social reversal. I think we're looking at a social and cultural reversal of all generations, because some of the most wasteful people I know are the younger ones.
As you say, it does take time, though. It took my wife and I 10 years to get out of the city. It took a lot of planning, and we had to figure out how we were going to live and all that sort of thing to get to a village in a food-producing area. Now we can walk to pretty well everything we need. I think that's the sort of direction that you're writing about, is it?
Yes, it is. Although one of the realizations, I think, is that not everybody has that opportunity or the options that you might have had. And I found that certainly as I have traveled and seen people in other parts of the world and the extent to which they have so little. I've been up in the hills of Kenya with a Maasai community that I've become involved with. And when I see how little they have in comparison to what even poor people have in North America, it makes you realize that when we talk about sustainable development, we have to live with a great deal less, but they need to live with more so that they can live at all. So it's a balancing of that global equation that I think we need to look toward, along with the realization that no one can step outside the game. So it'd be really nice if we could say that if we could only all go back to living in a natural state, the world would be a better place. But we can't. And there is no place we can hide from the consequences of human activity. What it really amounts to is how can we make a better choice today than we did yesterday? And while that seems incredibly futile and minuscule, maybe, it's really the only answer that we have that makes any sense. Because the situation we are in at the moment is the consequence of many billions of small individual choices that have created the mess. And the answer that we have is to reverse that same curve by making those same billions of small choices in a more sustainable direction. And when you start multiplying choices by the numbers of people who are making them, we do have the possibility of reversing course just as dramatically as we have embarked on one that has led to the destruction of the planet. So it may seem like small potatoes to, say, make better choices today than yesterday, but it really is something that you have control over. You don't have choices about tomorrow. Tomorrow never happens. But when we consider what things we did yesterday and the impact that they had on other people and on the planet and resolve to do something different today, then it's really quite extraordinary to see how quickly that sea change can happen in a reverse direction.
So it's taken you, Peter Denton, 3 books to explore how we might move towards sustainability and what it means. Let's start with your 2012 book, Gift Ecology, Reimagining a Sustainable World. What is that about?
Well, that was the first piece, and I'm an historian at heart, and I asked the question, what is it about our society that has led us to this unsustainable circumstance? And so I identified one key concept, the reality that we have increasingly lived in a world where things are valued and measured in linear mechanical terms that we can count, slice, and dice and pay for. And realizing that the mechanics of that exchange relationship and the linear mechanical systems that it involves created the problem, I asked myself, well, if this is a product of choices, where were the choices made and what was the alternative? And that was when I realized that the alternative to the mechanics of exchange has always been the gift. And it's a hard thing to identify in a historical context because even the examples out on the West Coast there of Aboriginal societies that valued gift-giving in very highly and organized potlatches and activities around that actually developed those activities post-contact. And then if you consider before what we have always done as humans, what we have valued as humans, we valued relationship, we valued beauty, we valued truth, we valued those things which cannot be bought and paid for, that cannot be sliced and diced. We valued a gift. And when you start looking at oppositions, the opposition between gift and exchange, I mean, a gift is something that can never be reciprocated, that can never be responded to except by accepting it. It's not like Christmas presents, right, where you give me something good and I give you something better. It's like the gift of life you get from your mother. How can that ever be repaid? Or the gift of friendship. You can be a friend in return, but it's not the same thing as an exchange where you've given me $5 and I've given you, you know, a hamburger or something.
And so true. And I value just sometimes sunsets and things like that, and they have no monetary value.
Exactly.
Now, you say that we cannot tweak the current system to make it sustainable, and I certainly believe that. We have to change the game. How did that work out in your 2014 book, the next in the series, Technology and Sustainability?
Well, continuing on that same question, right? How did we get here from there, and then what do we do about it? So in Technology and Sustainability, I asked the question off the bat that I used to ask my students in the course that I taught on this, whether they'd made an ethical choice today, and if so, what it was. The best answer I ever got was one guy who put up his hand rather hesitantly, and when I asked him what his choice was, he said, "I'm not sure. I know I must have made a choice today, but I just don't know what it was." So it occurred to me in that kind of a situation that we sort of have two parts to the problem. One, we have a world in which people make choices every day without thinking about them, and that explains a lot, because I always ask myself, why is it that perfectly intelligent, reasonable, educated, compassionate, nice people could make consistently self-destructive and stupid decisions? What's going on? And I thought, well, they're making those decisions that way because they're not thinking about them. That's half the problem. And then I got thinking a little further, and I said, wait a minute, what are they making those decisions about? And it occurred to me that they were making those decisions about a technology they didn't understand. We live in what is supposed to be the technological society, but when I sat down the first time I ever did this course to come up with a definition of technology, everyone I came up with exploded on me, and then I finally realized that I didn't know what technology was. But that was okay, because neither did anybody else.
Oh, we know what it is. It's computers. It's the smartphone.
Yeah.
It's a jet plane.
Yeah, precisely. It's objects. It's things that we can plug in or we can kick.
Yeah.
And yet, it's not. Technology is what makes us human. It goes back to the very dawn of human civilization, because it's not in our hands, it's in our heads. What I really wanted to call that book was Technology is in Our Heads, but that one didn't get past the editorial board. Really, what it means is that technology is instrumental knowledge, or knowledge we use to do something. And if you see it in that perspective, every civilization has had the technology it needed to survive, because it's the product of the choices that people make. It's not accidental. There's no such thing as value-neutral technology. It's the product of choices that people make. And when they're thinking, they make those choices for reasons, and those reasons reflect their values or what they think is important. So we can literally reverse engineer any piece of technology, any system, right back to the values that drove the decisions to create it and to use it. And if you don't like what you find when you do that reverse engineering and go back to the values that underlie something, well, then you change the values. But once you change the values, you change the reasons, the choices, and the technologies. And when you put those things in a row, it not only pushes you to think first in the gift ecology book about the fact that we're making choices, we need to open up the possibilities of the gift that are unleashed on the world where something completely unexpected is given to somebody else. But then the process for how to make those choices, how to live, involves intentional, thoughtful decisions that are based upon the values that we think are important.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Denton. We're talking about his new book, Live Close to Home. Now, in your most recent book of the three, Live Close to Home, you examine six threads on this pathway to sustainability. Could you briefly tell us what those are, and then we'll dig into a couple of them, maybe?
The first pathway is actually the one that I thought was in some ways the most fun. It's all about food. So if you're looking for a really close-to-home example of the problems of an unsustainable civilization, literally, I think that the line that I like to use in it is we need to learn to eat with a shorter spoon. Look at the distance to which our food travels, where it comes from, the fact that people no longer know how to grow it, that when they do find the food, they no longer know how to cook it, and you realize the extent to which our society everywhere is food insecure. We're used to thinking of people on the other side of the world who don't have water, who don't have access to seeds, who are in the midst of conflict situations. They're food insecure, but we're not. And yet, when you look at our system itself, if you're not able to walk to the market and find the food there that's grown locally, then it's coming in at a distance, and often an extraordinary distance, because we no longer rely on what's close by for our staple foods. So that's the first and most obvious piece, that even the food we eat is not something we actually have control over because we don't grow it. And even if we're able to get our hands on it from somewhere else, we don't know what to do with it when we get it. And so you can see the consequences for malnutrition, the consequences for obesity, and generally a state of ill health, even in an area where at least we would like to consider ourselves to be wealthy and food secure. But following from that is the second piece. It's the realization that we also don't have control over knowledge that is close to hand either. We are constantly pulling Google out and trying to learn something from Google. But all knowledge in the past, if you think of it in terms of technology, involved some degree or some significant degree of physical activity, of action over things in your immediate surroundings, your immediate circumstance. It's not just intellectual. It's not at a distance. It's something you have to learn how to swing that hammer. How do you learn? Well, it's physical, using your muscles, hand-to-eye coordination. And following from the problem that we don't know what to do with our food, the realization I came to was that we are actually hemorrhaging useful knowledge at a rate that is positively staggering from generation to generation. So much of that basic knowledge of the basic technologies that we've developed over thousands of years with how to survive is passed down orally from generation to generation. And all you need to do is, in an oral culture, is to disrupt that flow of information by one generation, and you've essentially lost most of what people know. And in Canada, you can certainly see that in the context of Aboriginal culture and the residential schools situation, where people or children were taken from their families, taken from their communities, told they couldn't speak their language, not allowed to follow their customs, and were given something else instead. And we can identify that, we can see that from outside and recognize it for the kind of culture crime that it was. But at the same time, we're doing exactly the same kind of thing when it comes to the sorts of information and technologies that have been passed down, you know, whether you're German or Polish or Ukrainian or whatever. There was a whole series of things that your great-grandparents used to know that you simply don't anymore.
That's so true. And I'm trying to recapture some of that, and the people that I know are trying to recapture some of that. And it does go back to food in a way, too, you know, how to preserve it, how to can it, how to make things and really be able to eat later. So you've got other items on your list. You've got reality, community, economy, ecology. Can we have a local economy? Are you pushing that as well?
Again, if we're looking for what it is we have control over, economy is one of those things. And if you look at the origins of agricultural economy, it always came out of surplus agriculture. We're not even growing our own food, but in the past, you know, the origins of civilization, as you move past the subsistence level, whatever you grew was something that then was traded to somebody who had something he wanted. And that was the origins of the early economics. And in that instance, we have control over what we have created. We have control over who gets it. When we give it away or when we exchange it, we have some expectation of a return. But instead, what we have with this society that is constantly living at a distance is a series of presumptions around the nature of the economy and our economics that's kind of like a giant Ponzi scheme, because the assumption is that somehow we have control over what's going to happen tomorrow. And I continue to share some of the concerns that people have around what happens when investors don't believe it anymore. What happens when you realize that all that money you've been socking away into your retirement savings plan is kind of pointless, because by the time you get there, the economy that you've invested in is going to implode. We assume that tomorrow is going to be there. We're told Freedom 55 is the answer, and we're supposed to invest for that rosy future and to see ads on TV. Everyone's sort of sitting around in the, you know, on their Caribbean island sipping rum punches. And yet that is so far from the reality that is rapidly approaching us that it's frightening. I've had students in class where I've asked them to sort of think about what they thought the world would look like in 2050. And we get the whole series of environmental catastrophes unfolding and all of the lines that we can see. And then I say, okay, now tell me what your life's going to be like in 2050. And they've just been paralyzed because they've got it all planned out with sort of the, you know, the spouse, the dog, the three kids, the house in the burbs, and the fancy vacations in Tahiti, you know, or maybe a destination wedding or two. And they realize that those two realities simply cannot coexist. And so that's really where the origins of all of those books have come from, is that we are constantly confronted by this dichotomy between denial and despair. Either everything is just hunky-dory, there's no problem, keep on going the way we always have done, living in la-la land, or complete despair when we crunch all the numbers and realize that there's no way out of the trap that we're in. And so most of us are kind of in the middle there. We'd really rather live in la-la land, and we're afraid we might live in disaster land, but we still have to go through day by day and live toward the future. And I think that that's where the discussion around possibility comes back into the picture, because in a linear system, you can predict what is going to come next. That's the point of a linear system. But you can only predict it if you understand all the elements of the system. Otherwise, it's like trying to guess the weather. You know, on the prairies, we can't even manage to get the weather straight 6 hours out, despite the fact you could send somebody up a tall building with a pair of binoculars and have a good look. So when it comes to complicated climate systems, I mean, any predictions of any significance are really kind of laughable. And so we feel trapped. The only tools we have are these predictive tools for mechanical linear systems. And we're confronted by the complexities of an organic system that we can't predict.
I think you've hit it spot on there. I live with that conundrum every day, practically. Things look good. Things are going pretty well. We got a great harvest in from the garden. Some happier days than I've seen in a long time. And yet I know that things are on very shaky ground, that my daughter and son could be in trouble, and my grandchild will certainly be in trouble. It's hard to live with that split.
Yes, it is. It's very hard. I've had students burst into tears in class over some of these conversations. But if you step back, this is the whole point of these books. If you step back and think, okay, wait a minute here. What else is going on? Yes, I get the picture. But what else has gone on? What else is going on? And you come up with a very different equation. Because if you are looking at a dynamic open system, as opposed to a fixed linear mechanical one, if a dynamic organic open system, it means there's all kinds of possibilities that are inherent in it. That's the nature of an open system. That's the nature of a dynamic growing system, is it isn't just one directional, right? And so if it's full of possibilities, why would we have to assume that the only likely outcome is that disaster scenario that keeps being thrown at us? Now, I think that the lessons of history, if you consider humans as capable of making choices that change the planet for the worse, they're also capable of making choices that change the planet for the better. And in fact, that's what history tells us over and over again. The tendency of our society is to see individuals as pointless, meaningless, and submerged in a mass of culture. Right? You're one person, Alex. You can't do anything about anything, right? You get up in the morning, you got to change the world. By the time you've had your second cup of coffee and you've listened to the news, you know that anything you do won't make a difference, and so you sort of give up. And yet that is fundamentally ahistorical, because if you look at history, no, there's been no single action for good or ill that has been of any significance in the past that has been the result of the actions of a group. It's always been one person making a choice and opening up possibilities as a result of that choice that simply were not there before. And that's the gift.
You are listening to author Peter Denton talking about his new book, Close to Home. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. So in this book, Live Close to Home, once we make this philosophy our guide, does your book give readers a set of steps to get there?
I try to avoid it, the idea of it being a manual. It's never that simple. I think that attempting to do that would be inappropriate, and I think attempting to give that simple answer is simply wrong. That anyone who comes up with a single-factor solution to anything is missing the boat. It's not possible. And so a little how-to primer in my book, it would be meaningless and be laughable in itself. What I'm trying to do is to reorient people's perspectives. Perspective is an interesting word. And if you think about what a perspective is, it's the relationship, something in perspective puts everything in view into a particular relationship to the viewer. Okay? Now, what happens if you move? The same stuff is still there. That's not changed. What changes is the one thing you have control over, which is your place, your perspective on the stuff that's there. And so often we look at a situation and we are locked into what's happening. There are no possibilities. We can't do anything. This is an inevitability and all the rest of that kind of language. If you simply shift perspective, all of a sudden there are possibilities there that simply weren't there before, because now you see things differently from a different vantage point. So if we consider our problems globally, I mean, that's not going to change. The levels of greenhouse gases continue to go up. The plastics in our oceans continue to increase. These things are there. You know, we still look at problems of what's happening with our food supply, with water, and all the rest of it. But if we consider that we have the capacity to make choices and change things in a different direction, all of a sudden there will be possibilities there that simply weren't there before. You are not powerless. The gift opens up possibilities that simply weren't there. And in fact, you're interviewing me tonight is a gift. You're not paid for it. I couldn't have bought it. I can't reciprocate it. I can't invite you on my radio show and tell you, get you to talk about your book. You know, it's not possible. It's a gift. So everyone who listens to this program, as a consequence of your gift, will think things differently and see the world differently, maybe even read my book, which they never would have heard of otherwise. And that is entirely because of what you did.
Well, Peter Denton, we're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything that I've missed that you would like to add?
Just that I think it's really important for people to read and to think. And those, again, seem like very simple tasks. But so few people these days are reading books. We far prefer to have some sort of skimpy thing coming in off the internet at us, and we don't actually sit and think through a book and think through what it includes and think for ourselves. So if you Well, as the host of the program can encourage people to read books, there's lots of really good books out there. Reading creates a different perspective than simply going down to the bar or taking a walk by the ocean. It encourages other muscles and encourages us to think through what it is that we believe, what it is we are doing and why we're doing it, what our reasons are, what our values are. And I am convinced that we have the capacity as a species to think this problem through and come out the other side with answers, not simple ones, not easy ones, not quick ones, not painless ones, but answers. That's what we've always done as humans. That's what we can continue to do if we trust each other and trust that capacity to make a difference by the choices that we make. If we resign ourselves to our fate, we are essentially creating our own outcomes by doing nothing and just letting the systems continue to spiral the way they are. But those systems aren't inevitable. They're the product of the things that we in the past have chosen to create. So we have control over what we do. We have control over that future. And most especially, we have control over what we think in response to the problems we're confronted with.
From Manitoba, Canada, we've been talking with author, minister, military writer, and more, Dr. Peter Denton. And you can find some of his lectures on YouTube and his newest book, Live Close to Home, in the usual venues. I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, it's been a delight to hear from you. I think that you've changed my life a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. You changed mine.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.